Chapter 27, The Evidence of a Galloping Runoff.
It all started with one act of rebellion. You see, the old king had passed away and so a new king was installed. Yet when the people came to the new king to ask him if he would relieve some of the older king's burdens that were put on them, he replied, "The old kind made your yoke heavy. I will make it even heavier. The old kind scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions." Well, this was the last straw, and so 5/6 of this man's kingdom simply walked away. They went north and established their own kingdom. But the spirit of rebellion never left them either. In fact, it got worse. Year after year, king after king, they not only continued to rebel against their former brothers, but they even rebelled against God himself. They set up detestable idols, a false system of worship, and became just as evil and wicked as the rest of the world. And so it was that God had reached his own limitations. The command was given. A pagan army was sent to take them out. But not just any army, oh no. This one was so horrific that just even mentioning their name struck terror in the hearts of everyone. You see, when this army took down a people, they flayed their victims, they skinned them alive, they impaled them on posts, they beheaded them. First, if they were fortunate, they burned them alive, they ripped out their eyes, and even cut off their fingers, noses and ears. Oh, but that's not all. Other acts included rape, mutilation until death, placing heads, arms, hands and even lower lips on the conquered city's walls, and skulls and noses were put on top of stakes. Then the corpses would be piled up and still others were cut up and fed to the dogs. Then on some occasions, people were blinded just so that they would wander throughout the land speaking about this army's terrible behavior, which would totally demoralize the local population. And finally, if you were fortunate enough to still be alive and chosen to be a captive, they just put a fishhook on your mouth and literally drug you off into slavery. And so it was that these once proud rebellious people, people who actually claimed to be the rightful people of God, met their utter doom. The book is 1 and 2 Kings. The judgment, of course, is the Assyrian captivity.
Now, folks, how many of you are familiar with the Assyrian captivity, when the 10 tribes of Israel went into oblivion? Okay, most of us are, but here's my point. I bet you most of us didn't realize the horrific manner in which that captivity took place, did we? But people, I'm here to tell you that judgment not only happened, but it came from where? It came as a direct order from God. Therefore, here's the point. You would think that people would stand up and take notice when God warns them about another future coming judgment, right? You would think that people would rightly conclude, "Hey man, I better get right with God so I don't suffer the coming judgment of God," right? But unfortunately, folks, as we've been seeing, that's no longer the case. Many people in our world today are not just having a hard time believing in God, but if there's one thing they absolutely refuse to believe in, it's in a future coming judgment of God. Therefore, in order to help these scoffing people hopefully become smarter people, we're going to continue in our study, The Witness of Creation. And what we're doing is taking a look at the 5 different evidences of creation that God has left behind for us, showing us that He's not just real, but that we really can have a personal, intimate relationship with the Creator of the universe, before it's too late. And so far we've seen the first evidence showing us this amazing truth is the evidence of an intelligent creation. The second evidence was the evidence of a young creation. The third evidence was the evidence of a special creation. And the last 4 times we saw the fourth evidence was the evidence of a judged creation. And what we've been seeing is there really was a global catastrophe, i.e. a worldwide flood, a time when God judged this world, not just because the Bible says so, but as we saw last time because even the evidence of a grand uprising says so. And there we saw it was the evidences of a massive water still down below, the massive dead things below, the mountains forming above and even the marine life found on top that showed us beyond a shadow of a doubt, contrary to what the skeptics say, that the topography on Earth we see on Earth today is not a result of millions and billions of years of evolution, but it's the leftover remnants of God's first judgment upon sin. Talk about a slick trick of the devil. Therefore, as we saw, there is no reason to scoff at the Bible. There's no reason to be willingly ignorant. There's tons of evidence that God judged this world once, and He's getting ready to do it again. And the point is, you better get ready. You see, folks, this is one of the major crimes of evolution. They not only try to explain away the existence of God, but they also try to cover up the judgment of God. In reality, we should be able to look at the topography of the earth and say, wow. Look at what the flood did, God's judgment for sin in the world. Man, God sure must hate sin. I better get right with him before the next judgment comes along. But here's the problem. Evolution has come along and blinded the minds of those who don't believe by saying the topography of the earth that we see today is not leftover remnants of a supernatural worldwide flood that occurred in a relatively short amount of time, but rather they say it's from completely natural events that occurred over millions and billions of years of time. And it blinds people from the evidence of God's judgment and a hatred of sin, which causes them to not even think about getting right with him. And yet, the flood not only did happen, as we've been seeing, but it happened not that long ago. According to the Bible, only a few thousand years have gone by since the flood, which if you think about it, really isn't that long ago. For instance, if you take an age estimate of 50 years old for the average lifetime, this puts the flood about 80 consecutive lifetimes ago. That means, the most incredible worldwide event to ever occur on planet Earth, between the creation of life and the second coming of Jesus Christ, really wasn't that long ago. And so that's the question. Who's right? Time's a-ticking. Did the topography of our Earth happen slowly and naturally over millions and billions of years, or did the topography of the Earth happen rapidly and supernaturally from a worldwide flood from God? Well, that brings us to the fifth evidence of a judged creation, and that is the evidence of a galloping runoff. But don't take my word for it. Let's listen to God's.
Genesis 8:1-5. But God remembered Noah and all the wild animals and the livestock that were with him in the ark, and he sent a wind over the earth, and the waters receded. Now the springs of the deep and the floodgates of the heavens had been closed, and the rain had stopped falling from the sky. The water receded steadily from the earth. At the end of the 150 days the water had gone down, and on the 17th day of the 7th month the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. The waters continued to recede until the 10th month, and on the 1st day of the 10th month the tops of the mountains became visible.
Now folks, according to our text, the Bible is clear. Once the water from above and below had stopped coming upon the earth after they had totally flooded the earth, what happened? God caused the waters to not just recede but to recede steadily. And that makes perfect sense because a world full of water is a whole lot of water to have to drain off, right? And if you think about it, it wouldn't just drain off with a little dribble here and a little dribble there. It would be a massive galloping runoff everywhere. I mean, once it got going, can you imagine the draining effect it would have on the earth? Can you imagine what it must have done to the topography of the earth in a short amount of time? It's the ultimate pulling of a plug on a bathtub. Only this bathtub is the size of the earth. And so that's the question. Do we see any evidence of this really taking place? Was there really a galloping runoff over the whole earth that carved out the topography of the earth in a short amount of time? Of course. But don't take my word for it. Let's look at the evidence. The first evidence showing that there really was a galloping runoff on the earth is rapid water. Now before we get started, you might be thinking, now wait a second. I have a problem with your bathtub analogy. First of all, who pulled the plug? And secondly, where did all the water go? If the world was covered in water and water takes to its own level, where could the water go, let alone flee? Actually, those are great questions. I would say that certainly some of the water sank into the ground, but the Bible provides the rest of the answer. First, the Bible is clear that it was God who pulled the plug. It was He who caused the water to recede or drain, if you will.
Genesis 8:1. But God remembered Noah and all the wild animals and the livestock that were with him in the ark, and he sent a wind over the earth, and the waters receded.
Secondly, yes, water takes to its own level, and if the whole world was flooded and stayed that way, it would have no place to go. However, the Bible clearly says that the water level started to change, and thus the water had a place to change or flee to. We see this in the above passage in the word receded. In the Hebrew it's shekak, which literally means to decrease or sink. The other part of the answer can be found in this passage.
Psalm 104:6-9. You covered it with the deep as with a garment, the waters were standing above the mountains. At your rebuke they fled, at the sound of your thunder they hurried away. The mountains rose, the valleys sank down to the place which you established for them. You set a boundary that they may not pass over, so that they will not return to cover the earth.
Here we see that the waters began to recede or sink, because that's precisely what was going on beneath the deep, or in other words, the floodwaters. The mountains started rising up, as we saw last time, but that's only half the story. What else was happening? The valley sank down. But you might be thinking, valley sinking down? That's quite a statement. Is there any proof that the topography of the Earth actually sank? Of course. But don't take my word for it. Let's look at the evidence. The first evidence of a sinking topography comes from fossils.
There are evidences that much of the present sea bottom was once dry land. Materials, like fossils, which are usually supposed to be deposited only in shallow water, have actually been found on the floor of some of the deep trenches.
Why are such unlikely fossils in a remote part of the ocean, 1,000 times deeper than one would expect?
In fact, even Scientific Monthly admits this strange finding.
There are fossil landforms preserved in the depths of the sea, where they are disturbed only by light currents and the slow rain of pelagic material from the waters above.
The second evidence of a sinking topography comes from coral.
Coral only grows near the surface, yet the remains of earlier coral are to be found deeper in the ocean.
Again, even evolutionists admit that something had to sink for this coral to be where it is.
For some reason that is not known, the whole great undersea range sank and, initially, sank fast enough to kill the reef coral when the coral dropped below its life zone of upper water.
The third evidence of a sinking topography comes from water lines.
It is quite clear that at some earlier time there was much more water in the enclosed lake basins of the continents.
Anyone who has ever driven into the Salt Lake City area cannot help but notice the high water marks on the surrounding mountains.
4 distinct marks are to be seen, the highest of which is about 1,000 feet above the present level of Great Salt Lake. At some earlier time, an area of 20,000 square miles was covered by this ancient lake. Scientists call it Lake Bonneville. Another basin of an ancient lake, Lake Lahontan, is to be found in Nevada. It once filled 8,400 square miles. Flint, in glacial and Pleistocene geology, lists 119 ancient lakes which are now dry or nearly so. Such raised beaches and terraces formed by ancient lakes are to be found all over the world. Immense upheavals as well as sinkings of land must have taken place in order to provide a place to hold the oceans. If that had not occurred, the entire Earth today would be underwater and there would be no continents.
Very frankly, this was an act of divine providence.
The ocean basins had to sink and the continents rise, or there would be no dry land after the flood.
And once again, even an evolutionist admits this truth.
Can we, as seekers after truth, shut our eyes any longer to the obvious fact that large areas of sea floor have sunk vertical distances measured in miles?
Folks, I don't know about you, but if you look around and take off those blinding evolutionary goggles, it sure appears to me that there's plenty of evidence that Earth's topography sank down at one time, just like the Bible said. How about you? So think of it. Mountains rising, valleys sinking. This would create a major topsy-turvy effect and the water would do just what the Bible said. It would flee right on out of there. I mean, put yourself in Noah's position. What a ride that must have been. Here he and his family along with all those animals are in the ark floating on top of the floodwaters, and all of a sudden, mountains started lifting up over here and the ocean began to sink over there, as the Earth's crust started cracking, shifting, tilting. It would be similar to this kind of chaotic scenario.
If your house were filled with 3 feet of water, and you were to lift one end of the house, the water would run to the opposite end, carrying with it all of the chairs, furniture, books and whatever else was in the water.
The faster the building is lifted, the faster the waters run away. If it is lifted slowly, the water runs away slowly. And so in the flood, how fast the mountains lifted up determined how fast the waters ran off. How fast the water ran off would determine how deep the canyons were carved.
It would be no problem to carve out the Grand Canyon due to the soft sediment in no time.
Or as another man states,
clearly, what the Bible is telling us is that God acted to alter the Earth's topography. New continental landmasses bearing new mountain chains of folded rock strata were uplifted from below the globe encircling waters that had eroded and leveled the pre-flood topography, while large deep ocean basins were formed to receive and accommodate the flood waters that then drained off the emerging continents. That is why the oceans are so deep and why there are folded mountain ranges.
So as you can see, when God caused the floodwaters to drain, they didn't just do a slow trickle here and there, but they what? As the scripture alludes and common sense reveals, they fled, they took to flight, they hightailed it out of there, everywhere, right? They rushed over the mountains and flew down into the valleys, carving out all kinds of formations that we see today, i.e. to the place God assigned for them, right? And so that's the question. Do we see any evidence of Earth's formations being carved out rapidly by water in a short amount of time? Of course. But don't take my word for it. Let's look at the evidence. The first evidence of rapid water creating Earth's topography is from rapid transporting. Now, if there really was a worldwide flood that experienced a literal raising of the mountains and a sinking of the valleys, then one would expect to find a massive transporting of sediments all over the world. So that's the question. Do we see any evidence of huge massive amounts of sediments being transported across the globe from the flood of Noah? Of course. In fact, it's right under our noses. We call it sandstone. It just so happens that we not only find huge thick layers of sandstone in the earth, but all around the earth. The problem is that evolutionist theory of slow gradual deposition of sediments, let alone sand, cannot explain this. So the question is, where did all this sand come from? Well, not so surprisingly, the evidence indicates that it was transported across entire continents by water that must have at one time encircled the globe. Gee, I wonder what that was. Here's what we find, as this article explains.
The Coconino sandstone, seen spectacularly in the walls of the Grand Canyon, has an average thickness of 315 feet, covers an area of at least 200,000 square miles, and thus contains at least 10,000 cubic miles of sand. Where did this sand come from? Also, the sand grains are pure quartz, a natural glass mineral, which is why the Coconino sandstone is such a distinctive buff color. Directly underneath, it is the strikingly different red-brown hermit formation, consisting of siltstone and shale. Sand for the Coconino sandstone could not have come from the underlying hermit formation. Furthermore, the sloping remnants of sand waves in the Coconino sandstone point to the south, indicating the water that deposited the sand flowed from the north. Another clue is that the Coconino sandstone thins to zero to the north in Utah, but the hermit formation spreads farther into Utah and beyond. So the Coconino's pure quartz sand had to come from a source even farther north, above and beyond the red-brown hermit. Grand Canyon has another set of layers with sand that must have come from far away, the sandstone beds within the Supai Group strata between the hermit formation and the red wall limestone. In this case, the sand wave remnants point to the southeast, so the sand grains had to have been deposited by water flowing from a source in the north and west. However, to the north and west of Grand Canyon we find only red wall limestone underneath the Supai Group, so there is no nearby source of quartz sand for these sandstone beds. Thus an incredibly long distance must be postulated for the source of Supai Group sand grains. A third layer of sandstone higher in the strata sequence gives us a clue. The Navajo sandstone of southern Utah, best seen in the spectacular mesas and cliffs in and around Zion National Park, is well above the Kaibab limestone, which forms the rim rock of the Grand Canyon. Like the Grand Canyon sandstones, this sandstone also consists of very pure quartz sand, giving it a distinctly brilliant white color, and it also contains remnants of sand waves. Within this sandstone, we find grains of the mineral zircon, which is relatively easy to trace to its source, because zircon usually contains radioactive uranium. It has been postulated that the sand grains in the Navajo sandstone came from the Appalachians of Pennsylvania and New York, and from former mountains further north in Canada. If this is true, the sand grains were transported about 1,250 miles right across North America. This discovery poses somewhat of a dilemma for conventional uniformitarian, slow and gradual geologists, because no known sediment transport system is capable of carrying sand across the entire North American continent during the required millions of years. It must have been water over an area even bigger than the continent. All they can do is postulate that some unknown transcontinental river system must have done the job. But even in their scientific belief system of Earth history, it is impossible for such a river to have persisted for millions of years. Yet the evidence is overwhelming that the water was flowing in one direction. More than 500,000 measurements have been collected from 15,615 North American localities, recording water current direction indicators throughout the geologic record. The evidence indicates that water moved sediments across the entire continent, from the east and northeast to the west and southwest throughout the so-called Paleozoic. This general pattern continued on up into the Mesozoic, when the Navajo sandstone was deposited. How could water be flowing across the North American continent consistently for hundreds of millions of years? Absolutely impossible. The only logical and viable explanation is the global cataclysmic Genesis flood. Only the water currents of a global ocean, lasting a few months, could have transported such huge volumes of sediments right across the North American continent to deposit the thick strata sequences which blanket the continent. The geologic record has many examples of sediments that did not come from erosion of local, underlying rocks. Rather, the sediments had to have been transported long distances, in some cases even across continents. This is confirmed by water current direction indicators in these sedimentary layers, which show a consistent unidirectional flow. However, conjectured transcontinental river systems could not have operated like that for hundreds of millions of years. Instead, only catastrophic global flooding of the continents over a few months can explain the huge volumes of sediments transported across the continents. The Bible describes the cataclysmic global flood in which the waters covered the whole earth, sweeping across entire continents. We would expect to find that these global waters eroded sediments and transported them across whole continents to be deposited in layers covering vast areas. We have now seen that this is exactly what we find across North America, so there is no excuse for claiming there is no evidence of a global flood. The global cataclysmic Genesis flood actually happened in the Earth's history, just as God told us it did.
The second evidence of rapid water creating Earth's topography is from rapid erasing. Now, if there really was a worldwide flood that experienced a literal raising of the mountains and a sinking of the valleys, then one would expect to find a massive erasing of land, or huge flat areas of land all over the world, that were leveled due to massive sheets of water coursing across the earth. I say sheets because in the initial stages of drainage or receding of the water level would still have been relatively high. Thus, the water would run off in huge sheets across the continents, making much of the area flat as a pancake. It's only later when the water level subsided even more that we would see the water then moving to stage 2 and start cutting out deep channels, which we'll get to in a moment. So that's the question. Do we see any huge flattened areas of land across the globe that were created by huge sheets of water moving across the globe from the flood of Noah? Of course. But don't take my word for it. Let's look at the evidence. The first evidence of a rapid erasing of land is from planations. Planations are giant flattened out areas of land that are called such because they have the appearance of literally being planed flat, just like a wood planer does to wood. Only the tool used was water, massive sheets of it, planing across the surface of the earth. In fact, they are not only amazingly flat, they are amazingly huge. Some planation surfaces are well over 600 square miles. Yet, from the way they have been eroded, we know they were even larger in the past. And just like you would expect to find in a worldwide flood, we find these amazingly flat planations all over the world, including the Antarctic ice sheet. In fact, thanks to modern satellite technology, we can now get a God's eye view of the post-flood world. And because of this, one geomorphologist, Lester King, documented that planation surfaces are abundant on all continents and found at different elevations. He noted about 60% of Africa alone is a series of planation surfaces. Oh, but that's not all. The second evidence of a rapid erasing of land is from pebbles. Another reason why we know these planations were caused by rapid moving sheets of water is because they not only leave huge flattened areas behind, but they also leave tons of rocks behind. As we know in modern albeit minuscule floods as compared to the flood of Noah, the water from a flood transports all kind of debris including rocks. As the flood waters subside, the rocks remain behind. So is this what we find on top of these planations? Of course. In fact, just like you'd expect from a flood, these rocks were carried away from their initial location far away to their present location. One researcher stated,
"If resistant rocks from a known location are found much too far for modern transport processes, they likely would have been transported during flood runoff. Peter Klevberg, John Hergenrather, and I have traced the location of well-rounded quartzite boulders for distances greater than 1,000 kilometers from their known source in the Rocky Mountains. Such long-transported rocks are known from around other mountain ranges.
But we not only find rocks on top of these planations, rocks originally from other locations, like you'd expect if a worldwide flood deposited them there, but we specifically find smooth rounded ones. And this too is to be expected because scientists agree that the only agent that can produce rounded rocks is rapid moving water. As the water transports the rocks along, they constantly tumble together producing the rounded surface we see today. And gee, can anyone guess what we find littered on top of these huge plateaus or planations? That's right. Not only tons of rocks but specifically, tons of smooth rounded rocks just like you'd expect if massive sheets of water from the flood of Noah really did plane out these surfaces. And finally, if you combine these two features together, water and rocks, you have a great gritty tool to make rough surfaces flat. Just like grit in a sandpaper helps to smooth out rough wood, so these rocks in the water would have helped plane and sand these planation surfaces into the flattened shapes we see today. In fact, this sandpaper action helps explain another phenomena that we see today in these planchions. They didn't just plane surfaces flat, they planed any surface, soft and hard. Just like someone taking a circular saw and cutting a smooth line at angle across the grains of a piece of wood, so we see planation surfaces cutting across tilted sedimentary layers. This is amazing since normal erosion produces uneven surfaces because it erodes soft material away first, leaving the hard material as ridges. But here we see both hard and soft material perfectly cut away evenly like a giant saw was applied to them. It is obvious that only some sort of giant, rapidly moving water source filled with rocks could have cut both the hard and soft rocks evenly. Gee, I wonder what that was? Can you say the flood of Noah? Speaking of sandpapering rocky surfaces, the third evidence of a rapid erasing of land is from peaks. Evidence of massive erasing or planation of land can not only be found down below in plateaus, but even high above on mountain peaks. If you take a look at many of the mountain ridges around the world, you'll notice oddly enough, that the peaks have literally been shaved off. For instance, we have the planed granite peaks of the Beartooth Mountains in Montana. How did solid granite get shaved off the tops of these mountains? Can you say a huge sheet of water from the flood of Noah as the mountains were rising up and the valleys were sinking down? And just like you would expect to find in a worldwide flood, we find these amazingly flat peaks all over the world with self-explanatory names like Flat Top Mountain, Table Mountain, or even Flat Top Butte, just to name a few. And speaking of flat tops, we not so surprisingly find these features in the mountain on land, but even the mountains in the sea. They're called, or guyots or table mounts. And they're not only found all over the world just like the ones on land, but just like the ones on the land, they too are huge. Just one of them has a surface area of 6 miles. Which brings us to the fourth evidence of a rapid erasing of land is from pitting. Now common sense tells us that these flat mountain peaks could not only not have occurred by natural slow processes over millions of years, but neither could they still be here if they were. This is because of the known modern rates of erosion. If these mountains have really been here for millions of years, how could these tops still be flat? They should have long since either been turned into pitted peaks. How could they have remained flat unless, of course, they aren't really millions of years old but only a few thousand years old, from the flood of Noah? Makes sense to me. Besides, using present rates of erosion, it has been estimated that the continents would have been reduced to near sea level in only 10 to 50 million years. So how in the world could not only mountains still be here, but even more importantly, how could they still have such huge flat surfaces on these mountains? Oh, and by the way, we don't see these planations being formed today. As one researcher stated.
Except for when a flood erodes solid rock along a riverbank, planation surfaces are not being formed today. In fact, the only change observed on planation surfaces is that they are being dissected by ravines and gullies, and actively destroyed.
In fact, the evolutionists admit their disappointment in finding an evolutionary answer for planations.
Understanding the long-term denudation, erosion, of landscapes remains speculative, despite attempts to find bridges between theories and the evidence which supports them. The existence of planation surfaces is asserted by a host of writers, yet few attempt any serious explanation of their development. It is perplexing that after a century of argument and observation of the continents, no generally accepted mechanism for planation has been forthcoming.
Sounds to me that somebody is being willingly ignorant of the flood of Noah. Here's a from a researcher who's not.
These observations fit well with the retreat of water off the land during Noah's global flood. High-speed water currents over wide areas would have carried rocks of many sizes. Moving rocks would have planed the surface flat, like sandpaper smooths rough wood. As the sea level lowered, the retreating flood water would have cut the landscapes at lower and lower levels, producing planation surfaces at different elevations. Present-day erosion is too fast for planation surfaces to be tens of millions of years old. Since planation surfaces are found all over the world, they provide strong evidence for a global flood as described in Genesis. In fact, only the Genesis flood can explain planation surfaces.
Oh, but that's not all. The second evidence of rapid water carving out Earth's topography is from rapid erosion. As was mentioned earlier, if there really was a worldwide flood that experienced a literal raising of the mountains and a sinking of the valleys as the Bible states, then one would not only expect to find a massive erasing of land, but a massive erosion of the land, leaving behind huge channels and seemingly out-of-place stand-alone formations of Earth. This would be expected from a worldwide flood because at the final stages of drainage or receding of the water level would now be at a much lower level and thus it would begin to rapidly carve out valleys, canyons, gorges, gullies and the like in no time as it ripped through the soft sediments before ceasing altogether, leaving behind the scarred landscape we see today. So that's the question. Do we see any huge channeled areas of land across the globe that were created by the final stages of water draining from the flood of Noah? Of course. But don't take my word for it. Let's look at the evidence. The first evidence of a rapid erosion of land is from water gaps. A water gap is defined as a deep pass or ravine that is cut at right angles to ridges and mountain ranges by water. At one point, an entire ridge was at the same height, but then some mechanism, i.e. water, literally gouged out a giant notch or gorge into the earth. And so that's the obvious question. What caused these giant gouges in the earth? Well, the problem is, the typical evolutionary answer of an antecedent stream of a superimposed stream doesn't seem to fit the evidence very well, as we'll see later with the discussion on the Grand Canyon. However, surprise surprise, the massive erosion caused by the drainage of a global flood does. Many geologists believe that these water gaps could have easily been formed during the final stages of the flood of Noah as the water flowed perpendicular to a ridge. Such flow would easily erode a notch in a short amount of time that would become a water gap after the flood that we see today. In fact, an example of this type of erosion effect occurred during the Lake Missoula flood when water broke over a ridge and created two vertical walled canyons nearly 500 feet deep. And just like you would expect from a worldwide flood, we find these water gaps all over the world. In fact, there are well over 1,000 water gaps from the Shoshone Water Gap in Wyoming that is almost 2,500 feet deep, to the 300 water gaps in the Zagros Mountains that are as deep as 8,200 feet. Only the massive erosion of a worldwide flood provides a sufficient answer to these geological formations. The second evidence of a rapid erosion of land is from water monuments. Not only do we see massive gaps or ravines carved from a global flood, but we also see massive monuments left behind from a global flood, which again, evolutionary answers fall short. Such areas would include Monument Valley, the Badlands, the Scablands, and the various mesas, buttes, and spires we see around the world. For instance, let's examine just one of these kinds of monuments, the Devil's Tower. Out of seemingly nowhere, it stands 1,267 feet above the surrounding terrain. Now, first of all, evolutionists not only cannot agree on how in the world this formation exists, but they further confuse the issue by saying the terrain surrounding the tower eroded away over more than 40 million years. But common sense tells us this cannot be. As we saw earlier, modern rates of erosion would have prevented not only this tower but all the towers for that matter in the same amount of time. In fact, it has been estimated that the Devil's Tower would have turned into a pile of boulders in less than 100,000 years according to an evolutionary time scale. So why is it still there and the surrounding terrain not? Well, can you say the flood of Noah? The Devil's Tower is better explained by a wide current of water from the final stages of the flood rapidly eroding and flushing out, if you will, the still relatively soft sedimentary terrain, leaving behind the more resistant rocks. In other words, the softer material was flushed away by the water while the firmer material was left standing. When all was said and done, a few of these monuments would have remained to litter the landscape, which is precisely what we see. In fact, this massive flushing away or stripping of sedimentary material, anywhere from 1,000 feet deep to over a mile deep, not only occurred, it occurred all over the world, just like you'd expect if there really was a worldwide flood. Therefore, it is any wonder that we're left with such tall monuments such as the above-mentioned Devil's Tower at 1,267 feet or even Ship Rock that's over 1,700 feet tall? Not at all, if you realize there really was a worldwide flood. However, you will be left scratching your head wondering, as many evolutionists are, if you don't. And again, if this were truly a global event, one would expect to find not just a few of these monuments still standing here and there, but everywhere, right? Well, gee, guess what? That's precisely what we find. Therefore, if you put the two flood erosion features together, large flat areas or planations and tall towering monuments, and you end up with what's littered all over our planet, mesas, buttes, and spires. They are defined as such.
A mesa, which means table in Spanish, is a flat-topped feature, formed by erosion, which rises above the surrounding terrain. Its height is less than its width. A butte is similar, but its height is greater than its width. A very slender butte is a spire.
The logical question is, how and when did these features all across the planet form? Evolution says it happened over millions of years, yet we saw this cannot be true. However, a few weeks of drainage from a worldwide flood makes perfect sense. In fact, all of a sudden a sufficient cause for existence of a monument valley comes into view. Instantly one can see why and how such features as the Badlands were formed. Immediately a clear reason for the Scablands is illuminated. As was stated at the beginning, why if I didn't know any better, I'd say evolution really is blinding the minds of those who don't believe in a worldwide flood. How about you? The abundant evidence is all over the place, if only people would remove their broken evolutionary spectacles. It really is distorting their view of reality. Oh, but that's not all. The third evidence of a rapid erosion of land is from water canyons. Not only do we see massive gaps or ravines carved from a global flood, but we also see massive canyons created from a global flood, which again, evolutionary answers fall horribly short. The first kind of water canyons we find that were obviously caused by a worldwide flood are land canyons. One of the greatest proofs of rapid erosion from a worldwide flood is right on the surface of the land. Of course, I'm talking about none other than the most infamous and obvious examples of this flood carving feature, the Grand Canyon. But here's the problem. The typical evolutionary response for the formation of the Grand Canyon says that the Colorado River carved out the Grand Canyon over millions and millions of years. However, we now know this cannot be true due to the various problems this answer raises. The first problem with the idea that Colorado River carved out the Grand Canyon is the dirt problem. If evolutionists want to say that the Colorado River carved out the Grand Canyon, then they have a major problem with the dirt. Simply put, where did all that dirt go, as these researchers remind us?
From 1926 until 1950, just before the Glen Canyon Dam was built, the daily sediment flow of the river was carefully measured and was found to average almost 500,000 tons per day, 168 million tons per year. The Grand Canyon is not presently undergoing much erosion. However, many geologists have recognized that there were some major problems with this idea. Among the worst is the question of what happened to such vast amounts of sediment. If the river had been carrying that much sediment for that long a time, this would amount to 168 million tons per year, times 70 million years, equals 11.8 million billion tons, equivalent to some 1.3 million cubic miles of rock. This is 1,500 times the volume of Grand Canyon itself, and should be easy to find. But there was no trace of such a huge delta deposit. Also, examination of the regional strata shows that between 1,000 and 3,000 feet of upper layer strata have been eroded from over 100,000 square miles of the Colorado Plateau, forming a giant peneplain. Where did all this sediment go? It couldn't just evaporate.
In fact, even one of Grand Canyon's most famous tour guides was caught off guard with this obvious dilemma.
John Hance became the first person of European descent to live at the canyon. He was one of the canyon's most colorful personalities, tour guides, and explorers. Children loved John Hance, and to them he always explained how the canyon came into being. "I dug it," he would say simply. This story worked well for years until one little four-year-old girl asked seriously, "And where did you put the dirt?" Hance had no ready answer. He never used that story again. But it bothered him the rest of his life, and when he was dying he whispered to his waiting friends, "Where do you suppose I could have put that dirt?"
That question still bothers geologists, because if the Colorado River carved the canyon, as commonly assumed, there should be a gigantic river delta where the Colorado River enters the Gulf of California. Instead, the delta is relatively tiny. In fact, the puzzle is much more difficult. Geologists now agree that the Colorado River began flowing out of the western Grand Canyon only recently. Here's why. Before the Glen Canyon Dam was built upstream from the Grand Canyon in 1963, the gritty Colorado River carried an average of 550,000 tons of sediment, sand, silt, and clay, out of the canyon each day, or 6 tons each second. About 800 cubic miles of material were removed in carving the Grand Canyon through and below the Kaibab limestone. The Colorado River's delta does not contain even 1% of this missing material. Where did it go? The second problem with the idea that Colorado River carved out the Grand Canyon is the elevation problem. The area near the present Glen Canyon Dam, which forms Lake Powell, is at an elevation of some 5,000 feet. But the region to the west, near the beginning of Grand Canyon, rises in the vast uplifted Colorado Plateau stretching for hundreds of miles called the Kaibab Uplift or Plateau, which lifted the previously flat strata some 3,000 feet. This is an obvious huge barrier for the Colorado River to flow through. Yet, evolutionists would have you and I believe that it somehow did the impossible and cut right through it. First of all, if this were true, the river would have simply gone around the barrier, and we would expect it to turn either southeast to join the Rio Grande and dump into the Gulf of Mexico, or it would have turned south and southwest to dump into the Pacific via the Gulf of California. But for some reason we're supposed to believe that the river refused to veer and kept refusing to do so for millions of years. Secondly, last time I checked, rivers do not flow uphill, let alone for millions of years. But if you listen to evolutionists, you would have to say that the Colorado River not only flowed uphill for millions of years but flowed up a hill that was several thousand feet and somehow didn't veer, somehow didn't stop, and somehow carved out the canyon. That's not science. That's too many somehows. The third problem with the idea that Colorado River carved out the Grand Canyon is the folded problem. Evolutionists would not only have you and I believe that the Colorado River flowed uphill thousands of feet for millions of years, but that the river carved through nice neat flat sedimentary layers that were laid down over millions of years. The problem is we find sedimentary layers in the Grand Canyon that are folded. For example, there is the folded Tay Pete sandstone in the canyon with layers bent at 90 degrees, a right angle, yet the rock was not fractured or broken at the hinge of the fold. Then there's the folding of the Mauve and Redwall limestone layers that somehow did not fracture and break as you would expect as these were ancient brittle rock. This not only ruins the idea of nice neat flattened layers over millions of years, but it shows us that these layers had to be in a soft and pliable state at the time they were formed in order for them to be folded without fracturing. This is exactly what you'd have in a worldwide flood scenario, not an evolutionary one as this researcher explains.
Herein lies an insurmountable dilemma for uniformitarian geologists. They maintain that the Tapiz sandstone and Mauve limestone were deposited 500-520 million years ago, the Redwall limestone 330-340 million years ago, then the Kaibab limestone 260 million years ago. Lastly, they say the Kaibab plateau was uplifted about 60 million years ago, causing the folding. That's a time span of about 440 million years between the first deposit and the folding. How could the Tapiz sandstone and Mauve limestone still be soft and pliable, as though they had just been deposited? Wouldn't they fracture and shatter if folded 440 million years after deposition? The conventional explanation is that under the pressure and heat of burial, the hardened sandstone and limestone layers were bent so slowly they behaved as though they were plastic, and thus did not break. However, pressure and heat would have caused detectable changes in the minerals of these rocks, telltale signs of metamorphism. But such metamorphic minerals or recrystallization, due to such plastic behavior, is not observed in these rocks. The sandstone and limestone in the folds are identical to sedimentary layers elsewhere. The only logical conclusion is that the 440-million-year delay between deposition and folding never happened. Instead, the Tapiz-Kaibab strata sequence was laid down in rapid succession early during the year of the global cataclysmic Genesis flood, followed by uplift of the Kaibab plateau within the last months of the flood. This alone explains the folding of the whole strata sequence without appreciable fracturing. The only way to explain how these sandstone and limestone beds could be folded, as though still pliable, is to conclude they were deposited during the Genesis flood, just months before they were folded.
The fourth problem with the idea that Colorado River carved out the Grand Canyon is the missing layer problem. Not only do evolutionists have the insurmountable problem of folded layers in the canyon, but they also have to contend with missing layers in the canyon. Again, evolutionists not only say that nice, neat, flat sedimentary layers were laid down over millions of years, but that they have a certain timely order in which they were supposed to have been laid down over millions of years. Unfortunately, the layers we find in the Grand Canyon don't cooperate very well with their theory.
One of the most dramatic of these breaks in the Grand Canyon strata is that between the Redwall limestone and the Muave limestone. The Redwall limestone is assigned by evolutionary geologists to the so-called Mississippian period, said to have been 310 to 355 million years ago, whereas the Muave limestone is said to belong to the so-called Cambrian period, believed to be 510 to 570 million years ago. That means there is a 155 million year gap between these layers. Evolutionists try to say this is due to erosion, but in parts of the canyon we see there wasn't any evidence of erosion between these layers. Thus, the supposed 155 million years of geological time is not only missing, but appears to have never existed.
In fact, they even have a sign posted by the National Park Service that admits it, saying,
"An unconformity. Rocks of Ordovician and Silurian periods are missing in Grand Canyon. Temple Butte limestone of Devonian age occurs in scattered pockets. Redwall limestone rests on these Devonian rocks, or on Muave limestone of much earlier Cambrian age."
In fact, there are not only missing layers, and no evidence of erosion between these layers, but these layers show evidence of intertwining, or what's called interfingering. Thus, as one researcher rightly concluded,
"It is obvious that this evidence overwhelmingly indicates that at least 155 million years of so-called geological time is missing, because it never occurred. This invalidates the evolutionists' whole concept of the geological column and the evolutionary progression of life. On the other hand, this evidence confirms the conclusions of creationists that these breaks and boundaries between rock layers in Grand Canyon represent very little time at all, and in some cases continuous deposition, as would be expected of events during Noah's year-long flood."
The fifth problem with the idea that Colorado River carved out the Grand Canyon is the missing rocks problem. Evolutionists not only have to deal with missing layers in the Grand Canyon, they also have to deal missing rocks. In 1882, pioneering geologist Clarence Edward Dutton observed the now accepted fact that almost all Mesozoic rock, at least 2,000 cubic miles, had been swept off about 10,000 square miles of fairly flat Kaibab limestone. This happened before the Grand Canyon was excavated by the removal of another 800 cubic miles of rock. To appreciate these volumes, recognize that all the water in the Earth's rivers totals only about 300 cubic miles. Dutton called this sweeping process the Great Denudation. He assumed that so much erosion required a very long time, but overlooked another possibility: lots of violently flowing water spread over a wide area for a short time. What would produce such a violent flow? Why must it have been a sheet of water? Falling rain would cut only channels. Flowing rivers or streams, even if they meandered for millions of years, would not sweep 1,000 feet or more of material off almost all of these 10,000 square miles of the fairly flat Kaibab limestone. Besides, meandering rivers would produce meandering patterns. Therefore, before you can excavate 800 cubic miles of rock below the rim to form the Grand Canyon, something must sweep off almost all the Mesozoic rock above, a much larger excavation project. Can you say worldwide flood? The sixth problem with the idea that Colorado River carved out the Grand Canyon is the misplaced rocks problem. Oh, but there's not only missing rock in Grand Canyon, there's even misplaced rocks.
Groups of relatively young, water-transported rocks are on opposite edges of the western Grand Canyon, rocks that could not have been transported from one location to the other if the canyon blocked the way. Therefore, those rocks were first transported, then the Grand Canyon was cut, and the Colorado River began flowing there. This is why since 1934, geologists have been trying unsuccessfully to find a previous location for the river, or to learn why the river began so recently.
The seventh problem with the idea that Colorado River carved out the Grand Canyon is the limestone problem.
Directly to the west of the Grand Canyon, the Colorado River cuts through a 650-foot thick layer of Hualapai, limestone whose topmost layers have been dated, using radiometric techniques, as less than 5,900,000 years old. If the river flowed through a lake that supposedly deposited this relatively pure limestone, why are common river sediments not found in that limestone? Obviously, The river must have begun flowing there after that limestone was deposited, in geologic terms, recently. How recently? According to most geologists, within the last 1,000th of the Earth's history.
The eighth problem with the idea that Colorado River carved out the Grand Canyon is the canyon problem. If the Colorado River really did carve out the Grand Canyon, then we should expect to find in the canyon normal river carving features that we can observe today. Unfortunately for evolution, we don't. Rather, we have side canyons, barbed canyons, and even slot canyons, all of which point to a sudden simultaneous formation. Side canyons in Grand Canyon are cut just as deep as the main canyons, but the problem is they do not have a visible source of water. How can this be? Had these side canyons formed before the main trunk of Grand and Marble Canyons, most would extend through to the opposite side of the main trunk. They don't. Had these side canyons formed after Grand Canyon and Marble Canyon formed, many would not cut down to the Colorado River, especially with no visible source of water to carve them. Therefore, these side canyons probably formed at the same time as Grand and Marble Canyons. Barbed canyons are side canyons going backward. That is, they connect to the main canyon backwards, similar to the barbs in barbed wire or fishhooks. Some barbed canyons are huge, a mile wide and 1,700 feet deep where they enter Marble Canyon. Tributaries almost always enter rivers at acute angles, but the barbed canyons are oriented at obtuse angles. Very strange. What happened? And finally, slot canyons are very narrow and jagged canyons. Obviously, the narrower they are, the less water was needed to carve them. How then, with so little water, were some slot canyons carved all the way down to the level of the Colorado River? The ninth problem with the idea that Colorado River carved out the Grand Canyon is the smooth problem. Another major problem with the idea that the Colorado River somehow carved the Grand Canyon is the carving features are not smooth as one would expect if a river really did carve it. This is because as a river erodes downward through relatively soft sedimentary layers, it eventually encounters a hard basement rock. Once there, any further erosion should be primarily horizontal into the softer surrounding sedimentary layers since the hard basement rock is resistant to erosion. Therefore, at this point the river should begin to erode a shallow, bowl-shaped channel, not a continual deep, nearly vertical cut as we observe in the Grand Canyon. Also, the eroded walls should be smooth, not jagged as are the walls of the inner gorge. Furthermore, if the river did begin to cut a deep slot, boulders, not easily moved by even a fast-flowing river, should fill up at least the bottom of that slot, thereby preventing any further scouring and deepening of the slot. This is what we would expect to find since it's how rivers normally carve out layers today. Unfortunately for evolution and their slow processes of millions of years, we don't see any of this. Rather, it appears that a massive torrent of water flushed through the area in a short amount of time. The tenth problem with the idea that Colorado River carved out the Grand Canyon is the debris problem. One of the most expected things we should find in the Grand Canyon if the Colorado River really did carve it is a whole bunch of debris or what's called talus. Talus is basically the piles of sloping rubble one finds at the base of cliffs. One would expect to find tons of this debris all over the place if the canyon is really millions of years old due to the freezing and thawing cycles alone over such a supposed long amount of time. Not so surprisingly, there is a major lack of rubble or talus at the base of the cliffs. How could this be if the Grand Canyon is supposed to be millions of years old? The 11th problem with the idea that Colorado River carved out the Grand Canyon is the repeat problem. Other interesting yet obvious and logical questions begin to surface if we are to somehow accept the evolutionary premise that the Grand Canyon was formed over millions of years from natural processes. 1. Why is the Grand Canyon where it is? And 2. Why are there not many other Grand Canyons worldwide? If it truly is a natural process, and we've truly been around for millions of years, then we should expect to find dozens of other Grand Canyons and even some that are more extreme. Unfortunately for evolution, we don't. The 12th problem with the idea that Colorado River carved out the Grand Canyon is the Indian problem. It is interesting to discover that the Havasupai Indians that live in the Grand Canyon themselves believe the canyon originated as a result of a flood. They have a tradition that one of their ancestors survived a great flood in a hollowed-out trunk of a great tree that acted as a boat. Finally, the flood waters receded and mountain peaks emerged. Rivers were created, and one of them cut the Great Gushing Fissure, which became the Grand Canyon. As one person stated,
"This is, of course, a recognizable, albeit distorted, version of the worldwide flood of Noah's day. It adds more evidence to support the fact that all peoples are descended from Noah and have a common cultural background."
The point is, apparently the people who live there in the Grand Canyon didn't have the privilege of evolutionists correcting them. In fact, speaking of correction, Even the evolutionists have to eventually correct themselves when confronted with these facts, as this one so aptly remarked.
After a century of study, we seem, if anything, to be further than ever from a full comprehension of how the Grand Canyon has evolved.
Well, maybe that's just it. Maybe it never evolved. Maybe it was created by the rapid erosion of a worldwide flood. So then that becomes the ultimate question, doesn't it? Just how did the flood carve out Grand Canyon? Well, most creationists believe it went something like this. It just so happens, thanks to modern technology and satellite pictures of the surrounding topography of the Grand Canyon area, that we can now see that if the Grand Canyon were to be blocked today by a 5,700-foot dam at its eastern end, this area would fill within with water. This is because there is a depression there, and this water would cover some 30,000 square miles, and would contain 3,000 cubic miles of water, three times the volume of Lake Michigan. In essence, these pictures reveal the evidence of a massive ancient lake that has been called Grand Lake. Another like it in the area is called Hopi Lake. In fact, we see the evidence of these once ancient lakes not only from satellite photographs but from freshwater fossils. Several traces of what are probably relic shorelines of these vast Colorado Plateau lakes have been found. Many fossils of freshwater fish, amphibians, and beavers have been identified as ancient lake deposits. Therefore, creationists propose that following the Great Flood of Noah, while much of the continent was still covered by water in these depression or valleys forming these massive post-flood lakes such as Grand Lake and Hopi Lake, an initial erosion began, from wave action, overtopping, piping, sapping, etc., and a catastrophic failure was inevitable. Grand Lake and Hopi Lake breached their boundaries and carved out the Grand Canyon in weeks. This explanation not only unravels the evolutionary confusion, but fits all the evidence evolution just cannot explain. Thus, the Colorado River was born as a consequence, not the cause, of the post-flood waters carving out the Grand Canyon. Oh, but that's not all. The second kind of water canyons we find caused by a worldwide flood are sea canyons, as this article shares.
On the ocean floor are several hundred canyons. Some of these submarine canyons rival the Grand Canyon in both length and depth. One canyon is three times deeper than the Grand Canyon. Another is 10 times longer, so long that it would stretch across the United States. Imagine standing at the edge of a vast depression that reminds you of the Grand Canyon, but the view across the 60-mile-wide depression is never obstructed by intermediate landforms. Many of these canyons are extensions of major rivers. Examples include the Amazon Canyon, the Hudson Canyon, the Ganges Canyon, the Congo Canyon, and the Indus Canyon. How did they get there? What forces could gouge out canyons that are sometimes 15,000 feet below sea level? Was the ocean floor raised or the ocean surface lowered by this amount so ancient rivers could cut these canyons? If so, how? Canyons on the continents were supposedly formed by the cutting of fast-flowing rivers and surface drainage. However, the current of flows measured in submarine canyons are much too slow, generally less than 1 mile per hour. Frequently, the flow is in the wrong direction. Submarine landslides or currents of dense, muddy water sometimes occur. However, they would not form the long, branching patterns that are common to river systems and submarine canyons. Besides, experiments with mud-laden water in actual submarine canyons have not demonstrated any canyon-cutting ability.
I'll repeat the question, how did they get there? If Grand Canyon didn't get there by slow natural processes, do you really think canyons 10 times the size did? Or can we safely assume, the Bible has been right all along?
Psalm 104:8. The mountains rose, the valleys sank down to the place which you established for them.
Folks, if I didn't know better, I'd say that after the worldwide flood there was a raising of the mountains and a sinking of the valleys on both land and sea, and that's precisely why we see all these amazing unnatural canyons all over the world. How about you? In fact, even the evolutionists are admitting it.
Valleys commonly appear to be far too large to have been formed by the streams that utilize them.
Oh, but that's not all. The fourth evidence of rapid water carving out Earth's topography is from rapid examples. Now you might be thinking, okay, so evolution totally fails in adequately explaining the existence of the Grand Canyon, and yes, it is quite interesting that we just so happen to see two ancient massive lakes that could have spilled over to create the Grand Canyon, but I'm sorry, I need a little more evidence than that. Well, For those of you who still need even more obvious proof than what we've already seen that a worldwide flood really did cause all these amazing topographical features on the earth, fortunately God is merciful to those of little faith. The first example of how rapid water can carve out Earth's topography in no time at all is from the Glen Canyon Dam. Speaking of the Colorado River and the Grand Canyon.
In the spring of 1983, the spillway tunnel of the Glen Canyon Dam that is on the Colorado River had to be operated to allow drainage of water from Lake Powell. When one of the spillways was fully open, the flow pattern changed and blocks of rock were seen hurtling out of the spillway exit. The water became red with dissolved sandstone and there were noticeable earth tremors. The spillway was immediately closed for inspection. The survey team discovered incredible erosion damage to the spillway tunnel caused by cavitation of the flowing water. In a matter of minutes, flowing water had penetrated the 3 feet thick, steel-reinforced, walls and ripped holes into the surrounding bedrock. A 150-foot diameter hole had been cut into the rock, requiring 63,000 cubic feet of concrete to repair the damage.
The second example of how rapid water can carve out Earth's topography in no time at all is from the Washington Scablands.
In the Scablands of eastern Washington is an even more dramatic example of the incredible erosion force of rapidly flowing water. An ancient lake was blocked at the end of the Ice Age by an ice dam in northern Idaho. When the water breached the dam, it ripped through Montana, Idaho, and Washington, leaving 16,000 square miles of scarred terrain and deeply cut valleys. At one location, the flood cut a 50-mile-long trench 6 miles wide and 900 feet deep through solid rock. An estimated 10 cubic miles of Columbia Plateau basalt was eroded in a matter of hours by this single event. Obviously, moving water can cause extensive damage.
The third example of how rapid water can carve out Earth's topography in no time at all is from Mount St. Helens. Probably one of the most amazing and specific parallels to the rapid creation of the Grand Canyon is the rapid formation of another miniature-sized Grand Canyon caused by the eruption of Mount St. Helens. When Mount St. Helens erupted on May 18, 1980, about 8 o'clock in the morning, it was reported to blow up straight out of the top, spreading ash over an amazing distance. It was equivalent to an atomic bomb going off every second for 9 hours straight, which is the equivalent of nearly 30,000 atomic bombs going off in that mountain. If you go there today, you'll see one canyon feature that looks like a 1/40th scale model of the Grand Canyon. How can this be? Well, when Mount St. Helens erupted, it started to blow off the top, and immediately the north slope collapsed and slid down the hill. Then the volcano began to blow out toward the north. As the ash, water, and steam came out of the volcano, it melted all of the glaciers on the mountain. It produced a scalding hot mudslide that slid down the valley. The scalding hot mud went racing down the valley, ripping down everything in its path. The mud slid all the way down and blocked off the Toutle River to the point that it completely stopped the river from flowing. Maybe as a child you went out and dammed up a creek to make yourself a fishing hole or a swimming hole. What happens when you stop up a creek? The creek becomes deeper and deeper behind the dam, and pretty soon the water goes over the top. The dam then washes out, especially if you're building it out of soft mud. Once it starts over the top, the dam doesn't last. The Toutle River was stopped for 5 days as the mud flowed across. 5 days later, the water got deep enough that the water began to go over the top of the mudslide. Once it started washing over the top, it started washing out canyons in a hurry. It washed out a canyon 140 feet deep, 1,000 feet wide, and 2,000 feet long in 15 minutes. A miniature Grand Canyon 140 feet deep in 15 minutes? It's no problem if you have a lot of water backed up behind soft mud. Also, two other canyons were formed by mud and pyroclastic flows, establishing drainages for the 1.5 by 2 mile crater. The primary drainage, Step Canyon, is up to 700 feet deep. To its east is Lewitt Canyon. Both canyons cut through 100 feet of solid rock, and like the Toutle River, creeks flow through each canyon. Oh, but that's not all. When the canyon washed out and then dried, scientists went down into that brand new canyon that was just formed a few days earlier. They noticed that the sides of the canyons were arranged in nice neat layers. In fact, there were stratified layers up to 400 feet thick formed as a result of landslides, pyroclastic flow, mud flows, etc. One layer was 30 feet thick and it was formed in less than one day. Others were extremely fine layers from only a millimeter thick to more than a meter high, and they formed in just a few seconds each. A deposit more than 25 feet in thickness contained upwards of 100 thin layers accumulated in just one day on June 12, 1980. If you step back and look at it, it looks just like the layering in the Grand Canyon. Normally, this sort of layering would be interpreted as taking a long time, but the Mount St. Helens eruption showed us that one catastrophic event can and does create these layers in a short amount of time. Is it any wonder that evolutionists were scratching their heads and saying, "Wait a minute. We thought it took millions of years for layers to form like this. It can be done in 15 minutes. Yes, that's why you need to get a new theory." Furthermore, one can easily imagine how in 100 years from now, an evolutionist who is ignorant of recent catastrophic history will be taking students down there on a tour saying, "Look what the Tootle River formed over millions and millions of years of slow natural erosion processes," when in reality it had nothing to do with it. The Tootle River did not form that canyon. Rather, it's the leftover remains of a breached lake that formed the canyon. And so it is with the Grand Canyon. Because the evolutionists are willingly ignorant of the recent catastrophic history of Noah's flood, they too assume the Colorado River formed the Grand Canyon when it had nothing to do with it. It too is the leftover remains of breached lakes that formed the Grand Canyon. In fact, the eruption of Mount St. Helens even showed us that you can create the same kind of formations that we see in the Badlands in just a matter of hours. During the eruption, the massive landslide carried huge amounts of ice and snow with it, burying them in the deep valley to the north. Throughout the day, 30 feet of 550-degree ash was also deposited, which quickly melted that ice, causing it to flash to steam. Water expands 1,700 times when it turns to steam, and when this happens instantaneously, it creates an explosion. As a result of these explosions, steam explosion pits up to 125 feet deep were formed. They had nearly vertical sides until gravity collapsed them to produce a rill and gully effect, one of the features of Badlands topography. Now folks, if I didn't know better, the world really was at one time covered in a massive amount of water, and as it receded or drained it caused a galloping runoff that carved out the topography of the Earth in a short amount of time. How about you? You know, it's like the Bible had it right all along. Go figure. Therefore, I'd say based on the evidence we just saw, there's no reason to scoff at the idea that God already judged his creation with a worldwide flood. How about you? In fact, I'd say if you persist, then I'd say you're not only willingly ignorant, but neither are you prepared for the second judgment of God that's coming sooner than you might think. Maybe you should stop being a scoffer and instead take God up on his offer to get saved through Jesus Christ before it's too late. Isn't that what a smart person would do, right? I think so. But that's right, if you don't want to take my word for it, then please, I beg you, listen to God's.
1 Corinthians 10:1-11. For I do not want you to be ignorant of the fact, brothers, that our forefathers were all under the cloud and that they all passed through the sea. They were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They all ate the same spiritual food and drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that accompanied them, and that rock was Christ. Nevertheless, God was not pleased with most of them; their bodies were scattered over the desert. Now these things occurred as examples to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things as they did. Do not be idolaters, as some of them were, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in pagan revelry. We should not commit sexual immorality, as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 of them died. We should not test the Lord, as some of them did, and were killed by snakes. And do not grumble, as some of them did, and were killed by the destroying angel. These things happened to them as examples and were written down as warnings for us, on whom the fulfillment of the ages has come.
Oh people, I beg you, please don't be like the Israelites of long ago. According to the word of God, they not only chose idolatry, revelry, and immorality over a relationship with God, but what happened to them? They were judged accordingly. Even though they claimed to be the people of God, their behavior showed they didn't really love God. But not only that, what else did the text say? These things happened to warn us today. If it happened then, it could happen now. We too need to take God at his word and truly be saved before it's too late. God's people give life service, not lip service. And so I ask you, what's it going to take for you two to stop being a scoffer and instead take God up on his offer to get saved through Jesus Christ, before it's too late? As you saw in this study, God's been merciful. He's given us the evidence of a galloping runoff to show us he judged the world once, he's going to do it again. And therefore, I beg you, like Noah did with the people of his day, please, please, won't you turn from your wicked ways? Won't you get right with God? Won't you escape the wrath to come? Won't you come into the ark? Please, this is not a game. Time is running out. The rain is going to be here before you know it, but then it'll be too late. Please, won't you accept God's offer to get saved before it's too late? And yet the Bible says that because the people of that day refused to listen to Noah, they all likewise perished. As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be at the coming of the Son of Man. How about you? Are you ready? Or will you likewise perish?